the caller ID, and one was a local number that I didn't recognize. I played the message on my voicemail. "This is Detective Shepard, calling for James Watson." At her chemistry set, Holmes peered into the bottom of an Erlenmeyer flask. "Yellow precipitate," she announced, more to herself than for my benefit. "Excellent. Absolutely perfect." Humming tunelessly, she poured the solution into a test tube and stoppered it, sliding it into her pocket. I listened to the end of Shepard's message with a sinking stomach. "Is there a bathroom nearby?" I asked her blearily. "I need to wash my face." She pointed wordlessly to the laundry sink in the corner, and I splashed myself with cold water. "According to the detective," I said, "they've all spoken to each other, and apparently my father is afraid I've hung myself from a tree branch, and we're all meeting in my room in 30 minutes. What am I going to say to him?" It was a rhetorical question, and a confused one at that, but she walked over to perch on the love seat's battered arm. "Your father?" she asked, and I nodded. She twisted her hands in her lap, and I noticed that the soft inside of one elbow was puckered with scars. "I heard it was going into her arm," the redhead had said. "I haven't seen him since I was 12. "Do you want to tell me why?" she asked. It was clear that she knew that this was what friends did, showed interest in each other's lives, offered a willing ear when the other was upset, and that she was doing her best to mimic it. It was also clear that she'd rather be pouring a gallon of water onto a live wire. Then again, maybe she did that for fun anyway. Who the hell knew? "You could tell me," I said. "I'm sure you've already come to some deductions, read some invisible bits of my past in my pinky finger." "It isn't a party trick, you know." "I know," I told her, "but it might be easier for both of us." "Easier?" Holmes sighed and tossed me my jacket. "Come on, or we'll be late." A sharp wind cut through the quad, but the sky above was mercilessly clear. Everywhere students huddled in clusters of two or three against the cold. Quite a few were openly crying, I noticed, as we walked past. Freshmen who probably didn't even know Dobson were hugging each other. But when they spotted me and Holmes, everyone just stopped. Stopped talking, stopped weeping, stopped telling tearful stories. One by one, they turned to glare at us, and then the whispering started. Holmes tucked her small white hand in the crook of my arm and powered me along. "Listen to me," she said rapidly. "Your parents are English, but you were raised in America. I know that from what my family has said about yours. Your accent isn't very strong, but how you stress your sentences is very specifically London. And you love London. I could tell from the look on your face when you first heard me speak, like you'd had a glimpse of home. You must have lived there at a particularly impressionable time in your life. Add in the fact that you said bathroom, not toilet earlier, and other times you've shied away from using any slang at all, rather than make a decision to be English or American about it. And so you must have moved to London around age 11 or 12. Am I correct?" I nodded dizzily. It was hard to hear Holmes talk, to learn that every one of my insignificant words and actions broadcasted my past, if one just knew how to look. But it would have been harder still to walk through the quad in silence while the rest of the school played judge, jury, and executioner. She'd known that, I thought. That's why she'd saved her deductions for this walk. 2 terrible birds, 1 stone. "Your jacket wasn't always yours. It was made in the 1970s, judging from the cut and the particularly awful brown of the leather. And while it fits you well enough, it's a touch too big in the shoulders. I'd say you bought it second-hand. Vintage. But everything else you're wearing was made in the last 2 years. So either you inherited it, or it was a gift." She slipped her hand into my coat pocket to pull it inside out. "Magic marker stains," she said with satisfaction. "I saw this earlier on the couch. I doubt you were carrying Crayolas around last winter." "No, more likely that it was around your house while you were growing up, and either you or your younger sister wore it at one point while playing at art teacher." "I didn't tell you I had a younger sister," I said. She gave me a pitying look. "You didn't have to." Fine, so it was my father's. It wasn't pleasant, being dissected. So what? You're wearing it, she said. That's enough to tell me you don't hate him. No, it's not as simple as hate. This is veering into psychology, and I'm sorry, I loathe psychology. But I imagine you wear the jacket because somewhere, deep down, you miss him. You left for London at 12, but your father lives here. You call him that, my father. You don't call him your dad. The very mention of him makes you tense up, and since we've established he hasn't been beating you, I can safely say that it's dread built up from a long silence. The last piece of it, of course, is your watch. We were nearly at Mishner Hall, and Holmes paused, holding out her hand. I didn't really see another option. I unfastened the clasp and handed it over. It's one of the first things I noticed when I met you, she said, examining it. Far more expensive than anything else you wear. A ridiculously large watch face, and the inscription on the back. Yes, here we are. To Jamie on his 16th birthday. Love, J.W., A.W., M.W., and R.W. Her eyes glittered at her discovery. No, at the confirmation of what she deduced. And I understood then what it would be like to hate her. Go on, I said, so it would finally be over. She ticked it off on her fingers. Despised childhood nickname, so he doesn't know you anymore. Very expensive gift for a teenager. Long-standing guilt. But the key is in the names. He didn't just give you a gift from him. He made sure you knew it was from the whole family. His new family. Your mother's name is Grace. My aunt's mentioned it. So A stands for Anna, let's say, and M.W. and R.W. would be your half-siblings then. Even his birthday present to you is a clumsy attempt to get you to love them. You haven't spoken for years because most likely he was cheating on your mother with Anna, Alice. When your parents divorced, he stayed in America to start a new family, abandoning, at least in your eyes, you and your sister. But your mother doesn't resent him. She didn't insist you box away a frankly ridiculous gift until you're older. This watch is worth at least $3,000. No, she lets you wear it. They're on good terms, even though they're divorced. Perhaps she's relieved that he's moved on, as she'd already accomplished that feat before the marriage had ended. Either way, she'd be upset that you aren't on better terms with him. A boy needs his father, etc., etc. Your stepmother must be younger then, but not so young that your mother disapproves. Abigail, I said. Her name is Abigail. Holmes shrugged. It was a small point to concede. Every other detail had been spot on, gold star perfect. The cold wind chapped at my face. It blew her hair about, obscuring her eyes. I'm sorry, you know, she said, so quietly I could barely hear her. I don't mean for it to hurt. It's just what I've observed. I know. It was well done, I said, and meant it. I didn't hate her so much as I hated being reminded of what my father had done. I couldn't seem to get over it. I hated the dread in my stomach as I looked at Mishner Hall's heavy wooden doors and thought about the people waiting for me inside. My father, the detective. I'm not guilty, I reminded myself. I wondered why I felt like I was. She took my arm again. You also wear the jacket because you think it makes you look like James Dean, she said as we walked in. The eyes are right, but the jaw's all wrong. And though you're handsome, you're no tortured artist, more of a wiry librarian, she thought for a moment. I suppose that's not all bad. No one else in the world would put up with this girl. You are awful, I said. And even then I was forgiving her. I'm not. Relief was written all over her face. How am I awful? I want examples. Give me an itemized list. Jamie, a hesitant voice asked behind me. Is that you? I turned to face my father. 3. I'd been told all my life that I was my father's spitting image, and after years apart, I could see it more than ever. The dark, unruly hair, though his was beginning to gray at the temples, and dark eyes, a certain stubborn set to the jaw. Watsons might be stubborn, he'd told me when I was younger, but we temper it with a love of adventure. Well, here was my adventure. A dead misogynist jerk, me the prime suspect, and my estranged father waiting to sit in on my questioning. Detective Shepherd hovered a few steps behind. Someone must have filled him in on my family history, and he'd decided to give the two of us a moment. In the background, Mrs. Dunham fussed noisily with an electric kettle. A series of mismatched mugs were lined up on the front desk. "I'm making tea," she said unnecessarily. "So many English people. It seemed like the thing to do." Honestly, she wasn't far off. "Cheers," my father and I said at the same time. Next to me, Holmes smothered a laugh. My father's eyes lit on her, clearly casting around for something, anything to say. "So, Jamie, aren't you going to introduce me to your girlfriend?" Her hand tightened on my arm. In horror, I assumed. I didn't dare look over at her. "This is Charlotte Holmes," I said quietly. "She's not my girlfriend." I'm not sure what reaction I expected. My mother would have gone thin-lipped and silent, saving up ammunition to barrage me with in private. "Isn't she a bit pale?" And, "She seems very unfriendly, don't you think?" And ultimately, "You know, she'll just bring you to grief in the end." My father was delighted. "Charlotte, wonderful," he said, and to my shock and Holmes's, he pulled her into a bone-crushing hug. She actually squeaked. I hadn't thought she could even make that sound. "Do you know, I sent my son all your press clippings. You did such marvelous work with the Jameson diamonds, and so young. You remember the story, right, Jamie? She'd been eavesdropping on Scotland Yard briefing her brother Milo, from behind a sofa in the library. Isn't that how it went? And then she wrote them a detailed letter, in crayon, telling them where to find the loot. Marvelous!" At that, he let her go, and she swayed a bit on her feet. "I never owned a set of crayons," she said, but he didn't seem to hear her. Clucking, Mrs. Dunham pressed a cup of tea into Holmes's hands. "Wait a minute," Detective Shepherd cleared his throat. "You mean that you're that Holmes, which makes you..." "Yes, yes," my father said, waving a hand. "That Watson. Let's go have a sit-down and clear this whole mess up. Where's your room, Jamie? Upstairs, I imagine." He strode off toward the stairwell, the detective at his heels. "She was 10? Shepherd asked, and my father's laugh echoed down the stairs. Holmes clutched her mug of tea in disbelief. "He hugged me." "I know," I said, making to follow them. "I think I might like him," she said miserably. I went back and ushered her up the stairs. "Don't feel bad," I told her. "Everyone does, except for me." The first thing the detective established was that Holmes and I both had alibis for the night before, courtesy of our roommates. The second thing he established was that those alibis didn't really matter. "We're exploring a number of options," he said, perched in my desk chair, "based on the forensic evidence, and we're not confining our scope to last night. I want to hear the full story of what happened between you two and Lee Dobson. After that, I want to hear exactly why, despite all reports to the contrary, the two of you appear to be thick as thieves." He looked at Holmes, then me, with narrowed eyes. "It wasn't my plan to interrogate you two together, and I don't think I can. Miss Holmes, since I don't have a parent present..."
"Check your email," she said smoothly. "You'll find a message from my parents, giving permission for Mr. Watson here to stand in as my guardian."
As Shepherd took out his phone, my father pulled out a notebook and pen from the inner pocket of his blazer.
"I don't need you to take notes," the detective said, bemused. "Oh, no, these are for me," he smiled. "I have an interest in crime."
Shepherd glanced over at me for help, and I shrugged, sitting down on the bed. I wasn't my father's keeper. It didn't take very long at all for Holmes to tell her side of it, how she had come here as a freshman, and how Dobson had gone after her almost immediately. Understandably, she left out the bit about him calling her a junkie, but I watched her tug at her sleeves as she detailed what he'd said to her. She hadn't been to school before this, and so she told the detective she wasn't sure how to handle his abuse. Others had witnessed it. Lena, she said, and her brother, if Shepard wanted to corroborate her account. "It's important to note that I didn't want him dead." There was steel in her voice. "Of course I wanted him to stop, but quite honestly, I was fine. His actions didn't have much bearing on my life here." I remembered her wariness when I first approached her on the quad. "Who put you up to this? Was it Dobson?" But then it was my turn to tell a few half-truths, so I guessed I couldn't blame her. Yes, it was true that I'd punched Dobson because he was being disgusting about a girl, a family friend, and because no one was saying anything to stop him. Yes, there were better ways of solving my problems. Yes, if I could do it again, I'd use words instead of fists, a lie. Holmes and I had fought, and very publicly, but I told the detective that I'd found her the next day to make sure there were no hard feelings. A lie. As I talked, I watched my father struggle to contain his beaming approval. When I described my right hook to Dobson's chin, he took notes with a stifled grin. Really, with role models like him, it was surprising I wasn't already in jail. For his part, the detective stuck to asking us simple questions and fiddling with the recorder he'd brought along. We'd given permission for him to tape our statements. After I told him that I'd snuck out of the dorm this morning to see if Holmes was okay, a half-lie, and that we'd hidden away in her lab to avoid our classmates, retroactively true, I came to the end. Shepard made a show of shuffling through his own notes. "I think that's it," he said, and I reached for my jacket. He held up a hand before I could stand. "Except for the part where, when we found Dobson's body, he was clutching your school library's copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, with one story in particular bookmarked. Or the part where you had sex with him, Dobson." He was facing Holmes, but his eyes were fixed on me. My father stopped writing. Nothing could have prepared me for that. I went cold all over. Then hot, I thought I might retch on the carpet. So Dobson had been telling the truth. Thick-necked, grunting Dobson, who I'd once heard brag about jerking off in the communal shower. I'd kill him. I'd hunt him down and strangle him with my bare hands, even if I had to resurrect him to do it. Next to me, I felt Holmes go very still. "Yes, I did," she said. Through that all-too-familiar blood roar, I heard the detective say, "Is there a reason you decided to keep that fact a secret? Not just from me, either. Looks like even your friend here had no idea." I shoved my fists under my knees. Was I breathing? I couldn't tell. I didn't care. "Because I was using a rather large amount of oxy at the time," she said coolly. "And had that come to light, I would have been expelled. Your real question should be whether the sexual act was consensual, which, considering my impaired state, it wasn't." She paused. "Do you have any more questions?" Her voice broke on the last word. At that, I had to leave the room. I stalked up and down the hall, shaking. If I didn't already have a reputation for being a violent dickhead, I definitely had one now. Peter opened his door in a bathrobe, shower caddy in hand, but after one glance at me punching the wall, he ducked back into his room. I heard him lock the door behind him. Good, I thought. The first person to look at me the wrong way would get the pounding that Dobson had deserved. As for Holmes, it hurt too much to think about her. Of course, the fact that she'd done hard drugs wasn't a huge surprise. Even without the rumors, I knew about the Holmes's long, storied history with cocaine and rehab. According to my great-great-great-grandfather's stories, Sherlock Holmes had always fallen back on a 7% solution when he was without a case. He needed the stimulation, he'd claimed, and Dr. Watson had only made cursory efforts to stop him. Oxy was just Charlotte Holmes's particular poison. Apparently, old habits died hard in this family. But I kept imagining it. Holmes stretched out on that tattered love seat in her lab, one indolent arm over her face, the empty plastic pouch beside her. That image alone was enough to turn my stomach, her eyes sparkling with a false fever,
a sweat on her brow. And then Dobson at the door, disgusting words on his lips. How did it unfold? Did he have to hold her down? I was aware then of my breath, as hard and fast as if I'd been running. I thought about it for another half second. Dobson's face, the empty pouch. Then I slammed my fist again into the cinder block wall. My father stepped out into the hallway.
"Jamie," he said in a low voice, and it pushed me over the edge into tears. I don't cry, as a rule. Nothing good comes out of fighting, I'll give you that. But crying? For a moment, you might feel a touch of release, but for me, that's always been followed hard by waves of shame and helplessness. I hate feeling helpless. I'll do anything to avoid it. I suppose Holmes and I had that in common. I half expected my father to try to hug me, the way he did her, but instead he laid a hand on my shoulder.
"That's the worst feeling, isn't it?" he asked. "That there's nothing at all you can do to make it better."
"I didn't kill him, Dad," I said, rubbing angrily at my face. "God, I wish I had."
"You mustn't blame her for this, you know," he said. "I imagine she's doing a good enough job of that herself."
I took a step back.
"I'd never blame Holmes for this. It isn't her fault."
My father smiled at that, though sadly.
"You're a good man, Jamie Watson. Your mother's raised you well."
This was territory that I couldn't get into, not then, and he must have seen it on my face. I waited for him to insist that I sign off campus to go home with him. It would be a reasonable suggestion after everything that had happened, but he didn't.
"Come by for dinner next Sunday," he said instead. "Bring Charlotte. You still like steak pie, I'm sure."
There wasn't a question there to say no to, and before I could find a way to protest anyway, he said,
"It'll just be the three of us."
No step family, he meant. I found myself nodding. Detective Shepherd came out into the hall, ushering along an ashen Holmes. Her composure was eggshell thin, but intact. I admired her self-possession, and still I wanted to be a million miles away.
"Next Sunday, then," my father said,
and fixed the detective with a look that said the interview was absolutely over. Shepherd stood there for an awkward moment.
"Neither of you leave town without telling me. We'll talk again soon."
He followed my father down the stairs. Holmes and I stared at each other.
"You've been crying," she said,
more hoarse than usual. She lifted a tentative hand to touch my face.
"Why?"
I wanted to shout at her. I couldn't turn my feelings off like I was a machine, and as much as she pretended to be one, her spotless appearance, the precise way she spoke, I knew she couldn't either. Her emotions had to be roiling somewhere, deep below the surface, and I wanted to demand that she pull them out for my inspection, as if it were my right. But instead, I covered her cold hand with mine.
"I won't make you talk about it," I said.
"Yes," she said, withdrawing.
"Don't."
"Okay." I took a deep breath to steady myself.
"Did you give him whatever it was that you slipped into your pocket? That vial?"
"I did." It was like pulling teeth.
"Are you going to tell me what it was?"
She considered it for a moment. Considered me.
"Watson," she said. "It looks like we're being framed."
Mrs. Dunham wouldn't let us leave without a promise to go first to the infirmary. My knuckles were bleeding after I'd punched that wall, my fingers bruised and swollen. Holmes promised her we would, and she sat patiently as the nurse examined me.
"You're becoming quite irregular," she said,
tisking, and gave me bandages and an ice pack. Holmes ducked into the dining hall to make us sandwiches while I waited by the door. I was surprised that she would remember to eat, as I'd been too upset to realize that I was starving. We were both, I think, too overwhelmed by our internal weather to pay much attention to what was happening outside. This time, the stares and whispers as we crossed the quad didn't bother me. How could they? I had so much more to worry about. Up at Sciences 442, Holmes produced a ring of keys and let us in.
"How did you con them into giving you a lab?" I asked, thankful for a neutral subject to discuss.
"My parents made it a stipulation of my acceptance," she said. Around us, the lab was as strange and dark as we'd left it. Sherrinford was quite eager to have me, and so they agreed. On my transcript, the work I do here is listed as an independent study. I smirked.
In what? Murder?
She wrinkled her nose at me. For those few minutes, I'd forgotten about Dobson, but the sight of the battered love seat brought it crashing back. I watched her watch me remember, and with a gust of energy, she slammed the door shut. It didn't happen here, she said matter-of-factly. It happened in Stevenson. Yes, I generally do oxy here when I do downers, so that was an exception. Yes, it was immensely upsetting. Yes, I do get upset. No, I'd rather not tell you the details. I don't want you to know the details. I didn't kill him, and I didn't hire anyone to kill him. I had nothing to do with his death. As I've told you before, I can fight for myself, so stop looking at me like I'm an object for your pity.
I don't pity you, I said, stunned.
She turned to the wall, but I could still see her close her eyes, come backward silently from 10. No, she said, without turning around. You just choose to feel all the things that I can't, or don't. It's overwhelming. We've been friends for less than a day. She paused. Though I suppose we're neither of us very normal. No one had considered me anything but normal before this, though I was sure that hadn't been the case for her. After a long minute, I sat down on her disgusting couch. Here is your lunch, I said, picking up the sandwiches from where she dropped them on the floor. Normal people eat lunch, and so, for these 5 minutes, we are going to be normal. After that, you're free to tell me who's framing us for murder. She flopped down beside me. I don't have the who yet, she said. Not enough data. Normal, I warned her. At least try. I wolfed my sandwich down, even though it was pastrami and lettuce on white bread. Full stop. No condiments. It was the kind of sandwich only a posh girl with a personal chef and the appetite of a hummingbird would have made, and so maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. For her part, she ate a listless bite or two, eyes fixed on the middle distance. What do normal people talk about? She asked me. Football, I hazarded. She rolled her eyes. Okay, did you see that new cop movie? Fiction is a waste of time, she said, pulling a shred of lettuce out of her sandwich and nibbling on its end. A snail. She ate like a snail. I'm far more interested in real events.
Like?
There was a positively fascinating series of murders in Glasgow last week. Three girls, each garrotted with her own hair. She smiled to herself. Clever. Honestly, I didn't even leave the lab as it unfolded. I was so taken with it. I called in some tips to my contact at Scotland Yard, and she wanted to fly me out to investigate. Then this happened.
How inconvenient, I said.
She, of course, ignored the sarcasm. It was, wasn't it? Okay, normal lunch is an abject failure, I said. So, just get on with it. Why are we being framed? You're asking the wrong questions, she said, tossing the sandwich on the floor as she stood. I picked it up and put it in the trash. We're not on who or why, Watson. We're still working out how. You can't theorize in advance of facts, or you'll waste everyone's time. I don't understand, I said, because I didn't. I swear she nearly stamped an impatient foot. Fact one. Lee Dobson tormented me for an entire year before assaulting me on September 26. Fact two. You and Dobson got into an altercation on October 3rd. Fact three. Dobson was murdered on Tuesday, October 11th. Close enough to both incidents to link them all together. When his toxicology reports come back, they'll prove that Dobson was a victim of gradual arsenic poisoning, that it began the night you first punched him, and that the doses increased in amount until the night he died. I'm sure that his roommate and the infirmary will testify to the attendant headaches, nausea, and so on. Jesus Christ, I stared at her. Arsenic? Don't tell me you have access to arsenic. Watson, she said patiently, we are in the sciences building, and I have the keys. I put my head in my hands. He was holding a copy of your great-great-great-grandfather's stories. They'll also find that last night, Dobson was the victim of a rattlesnake bite, perhaps even shortly post-mortem, while the blood was still warm. Remember the scale that I found on Dobson's floor? Stooping, she pulled a book from the bottom of her bookshelf and tossed it to me. I was startled to see it was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. No, how about the glass of milk on his bedside table, or the vent above his bed? Come on, Watson, think! I blinked down at the book in my hands, not quite believing what she was implying. You can't be serious. Oh, I'm quite serious. They're recreating The Speckled Band. The Adventure of the Speckled Band is one of my great-great-great-grandfather's most well-known stories. It's definitely the most frightening, and also the most riddled with factual errors. As so many of his tales do, The Speckled Band opens in 221B Baker Street with a shaken woman asking for help. Her sister had died 2 years before in the middle of the night under mysterious circumstances, and now Helen Stoner, Holmes's client, has been moved by her patently evil stepfather into that same bedroom weeks before her wedding. During their investigation, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson find that the bed in that room is bolted to the floor. Beside it, a bell pull trails down from a vent above that opens into the stepfather's study next door. There, Holmes finds a saucer of milk, a leash, a locked safe, and, during their stakeout, an Indian swamp adder, the speckled band of the title that evil stepfather is using to kill his stepdaughters, controlling the snake with a whistle and tossing it into the safe when he's finished. John H. Watson might have been many things, a doctor, a storyteller, and by most accounts a kind and decent man, but he clearly wasn't a zoologist. There's no such thing as a swamp adder, and the idea that Sherlock Holmes deduced its existence from a saucer of milk is ridiculous. Snakes have zero interest in milk. They also can't hear anything but vibrations, so they wouldn't hear a whistle. But they do breathe, so a snake couldn't survive in a locked safe. When I was younger, my father and I liked to speculate about what actually happened on that case to drive Dr. Watson to that much invention. My pet theory is still that he slept late that day in Baker Street, missed both the client and the investigation entirely, and was only half-listening when Sherlock Holmes broke it down for him later. At least, that sounds like something I would do. "Whoever they are, they're taunting us," Holmes was saying, pacing the length of her lab like a caged cat. "The arsenic would have done Dobson in on its own. The snake is just a ridiculous flourish, there to send a message. Of course, our culprit couldn't find a swamp adder, because your great-great-great-grandfather made those up." I rolled my eyes at her clear disdain. "But honestly, Watson, why would Dobson have a glass of milk? There wasn't a mini-fridge in his room. He'd have to carry it back from the dining hall after dinner. And while I suppose it's possible that Lee Dobson had discovered a passion for folk music, having a slide whistle is too strange in the context of everything else. The presence of these items is just plausible enough that the police wouldn't see them as significant, and so in planting them there, the killer must have known we would make our own investigation." "We're being toyed with," I said. "But why would he want us to know he's after us?" "Us, specifically," she arched an eyebrow. "Dobson was after me all last year and nothing happened to him. Then you show up and all this starts. We'll begin by investigating people who arrived in the area since the summer, or those who have a particular stake in bringing the both of us down." Why would anyone be after me? Holmes, I understood. She was so clearly smarter than, faster than, braver than. There had to be someone on the other side of that equation to make it work. Maybe I was just collateral damage. Maybe there had been some mistake. Because no matter how badly I wanted my life to be interesting, it wasn't. There was no reason for anyone to target me. But if Holmes realized how unimportant a role I actually played in all of this, she might send me packing. Back to chemistry homework and Tom's dirty jokes, and all the other trappings of my American exile. Back to dreaming about her at night while she went on, unmoved with her life. But it would be worse this time, because I'd know exactly what I was missing. I decided to keep my mouth shut. Holmes stopped pacing to lean against the wall for support. I remembered that she hadn't slept at all last night. I had no idea how she was still on her feet. "The police aren't going to let us help them, not if Shepard's any indication," she said. Idiots. I suppose that they don't like that I tampered with their crime scene.
We're also their prime suspects, I reminded her. That sort of puts a damper on our working relationship.
She shrugged as if that were beside the point.
That's it, then.
What is?
That's all I have to tell you. I'll think on our next move.
It was a dismissal. Whatever use she'd had for me had expired, and our investigation was done for the day. I got to my feet, wondering if I'd made a misjudgment in thinking that I was starting to mean something to her. Because it seemed that Holmes had already forgotten me. She brought down her violin case from its shelf and drew from it an instrument so warm and polished that it nearly looked alive. I remembered listening to a special on BBC Four in my kitchen that past summer, in such a profound sulk at leaving that my mother had begun a campaign to cheer me up. That day she was making cinnamon buns by hand, rolling out the dough in long strips that dangled off the edge of our tiny countertop, and I'd crept from my room, drawn by the smell of the sugar. She looked up at me with floured hands, a brown curl stuck to the side of her face. And before either of us could speak, the radio presenter announced a feature on the history of the Stradivarius. Underneath his voice played the famous recording of Sherlock Holmes performing a Mendelssohn concerto on his own Stradivarius for King Edward VII. The music was scratchy and still tremendously alive through the static. I'd drawn nearer, and my mother had pursed her lips but didn't change the station. And so we spent the afternoon that way, icing the rolls she'd made as they cooled and listening to the announcer speak of the violin's shape, the density of its wood, how Antonio Stradivari had stored his instruments under Venice's canals. The brown sugar color of Holmes's violin brought it all back to me in a rush, and I stood there, transfixed, watching her run through a scale before beginning to play. The bow stood out against her dark hair. Her eyes were closed. The song was both familiar and alien, a folk melody punctuated by bursts of gorgeous dissonance. Though I was standing only a few feet away, the distance between us stretched like the 100 years between Sherlock Holmes playing for the king and my hearing it. That remote, that distant. I must have listened for a long time before she stopped playing, and I realized that I was standing frozen with my hand on the doorknob, like a fool.
Watson, she said, letting the violin drop to her side. I'll see you tomorrow.
She turned away from me and began to play again. 4. After I avoided all my calls for another day, Mrs. Dunham came by my room and politely told me that if she had to speak to my panicked mother one more time, she would very publicly set herself on fire. So that Thursday I had to endure my mom's histrionics and my sister Shelby's 1,000 questions. What happened? Are you okay? Does this mean that you can come home? A call that went on for hours. I told neither of them that I'd been invited to my father's house for dinner. I still hadn't decided if I would go. Things settled down between Tom and me, or rather, Tom's good nature won out over his suspicions, and after a day of uncomfortable silence, he came over to my desk while I was writing. I'd been scribbling down everything I could remember since Dobson's murder. Times and dates, names of poisons, those things of Dobson's that Holmes had catalogued with her hands. I was thinking of making a story of it, and when Tom peered over my shoulder, it was easy enough to try it out on him. Or to try out the version that wouldn't get either Holmes or me expelled. Sherrinford had released a statement referring to Lee Dobson's death as an accident with a snake, which came off much more bizarre than terrifying. It was their attempt to reassure parents that our campus was safe, but students were still being dragged home in droves. Our hall, in particular, had an emptied-out feeling to it. For 2 days running, there was no line for the shower, no music blaring from behind closed doors. Into that silence, the reporters appeared. One day they weren't there, the next they were everywhere, crawling all over the quad with their cameras and flashbulbs and strident voices. They lay in wait after our classes, putting sympathetic hands on our shoulders and pointing the lenses into our faces. Most of the students ignored them. Some didn't. One day, during lunch, I watched the red-headed girl from my French class crying delicately into a camera. Her headshots, she sobbed, were on her website if they needed them.
I guess I couldn't blame her for using the press. The press were using her, too. That same reporter took a particular shine to me, following me from class to class, murmuring words of sympathy before launching into questions like, "Do you really think Lee Dobson's death was an accident?" And, "Is it true you keep a snake in your dorm room?" From the logo on the cameraman's kit, I knew they were from the BBC. I would have known it anyway from the reporter's plummy accent and haughty chin, the very image of some grown-up Oxbridge wanker. He'd been sent across the pond to try to get some dirt on the Holmeses. I was sure by the way he kept turning the conversation back to Charlotte. Somehow he'd gotten a hold of my class schedule, and for days he waited for me between classes, his cameraman always towering behind him. The worst was the afternoon I thought I'd gotten away clean. The two of them were talking to a townie on the sciences building steps as I came out the front door. "Yeah, man," he was telling them. "I've heard the stories, too. I have a lot of, friends who say Charlotte Holmes is the head of this messed-up cult, and James Watson is like her angry little henchman." I hurried past them, head down, but the reporter charged after me, calling my name, reaching out to pull on my arm. I whipped around, ready to deck him. A cameraman stepped forward eagerly, training his lens on my face. "See what I mean?" the townie said. I got a good look at him this time. He was around 30 years old, with mean little features and thick blonde hair. Tom had pointed him out to me as the campus drug dealer. I'd seen him lurking around campus at night. Apparently these days he had more credibility than I did. "Back off," I said quietly, and put my collar up. They let me walk on alone, but we all knew they'd be back the next day. Except they weren't. Evidently, the reporters bothered enough of us that parents had begun to complain. Sherringford officially closed our campus to the public. When I asked Holmes if she was relieved, she smiled politely. "My brother has an arrangement with the press," she said. "They've never bothered me." Morale was low, and so it wasn't a surprise that the school decided to go ahead with our homecoming weekend despite all the commotion. Our school's green and white banners streamed from the chapel and the library. The dining hall announced they would be serving steak and salmon for dinner. In the days leading up to the dance, girls walked in droves to town and returned with long dresses and tied-off plastic bags. They had ordered them months before, from New York and Boston, and one even from Paris. That was according to Cassidy and Ashton, who gossiped relentlessly through every one of our French classes. But it wasn't just girls who were preening in preparation. Tom was taking Lena, and he must have had his parents ship him his suit from Chicago. I had no idea how else he'd get his hands on a powder blue jacket and vest. It might have been a waste of time and money, but for once I understood it. Better to focus on pageantry than on death. When I told Holmes that, she threw her head back in one of her rare laughs. "For a boy, you are massively melodramatic." I really couldn't argue with that. She had plenty of data to draw from, because I spent every spare moment I had in Sciences 442. We had lunch there and dinner, or rather I ate in the ravenous way I always did, while she made a series of deductions about my day. "You had Captain Crunch for breakfast," she'd say, "and you've tried a new shaving cream you don't like," the whole while pushing her food around her plate to disguise the fact that she wasn't eating. I bothered her about that, the way she picked at her food, and she'd eat a fry or two to appease me. 10 minutes later, I'd bother her some more. One night, I mentioned that my favorite song was Nirvana's Heart-Shaped Box, and an hour later, messing around on her violin, she played the opening measures of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I don't think she realized she'd been doing it. When she caught my gaze, she jumped about a foot and slid directly into Bach's Allemande. I learned the names of everything she played. She liked when I asked, and I liked to listen. The way we were with each other wouldn't have made sense to anyone else if I'd tried to explain it. I had a habit of volleying any ridiculous statement she'd make back over the net with topspin, and we'd ramp ourselves up into fierce arguments that way about Beatles and Christmas plays and the color of Dr. Watson's eyes. We bickered over possible suspects. She was sure that our murderer had a Sherringford association, but I couldn't imagine why he or she wouldn't have acted the year before.
I still couldn't imagine why I'd be a target. When I found a nest of prescription bottles hidden in her violin case, we had a pitched battle over the fact that she was still using Oxy. "It's none of your business," she'd said, furious, and grew even angrier when I insisted that it, in fact, was. How could it not be? I was her friend. Maybe that's why the worst rows we had were about nothing at all. After we had it out one night about the way she always sprawled out on the love seat, leaving me to sit on the floor, I stormed from the lab to find, the next morning, that she'd brought in a folding chair. "For you," she said, with an idle gesture. It was all we really had room for in that small space. But we didn't always egg each other on like that. More often it was the opposite. Instead of yelling at her, I'd find myself sucked in by her hypnotic stare and unrelenting train of logical thought until I was letting her do something like pluck out my nose hair for an experiment. To be fair, she did promise to do my chemistry homework for a month in exchange. She taught me how to pick a basic lock, and after I'd finally maneuvered my pins into the right position and heard the telltale click and fallen back against the love seat in relief, she pulled the blindfold over my eyes and made me do it again. Later, after Holmes said she hadn't been allowed any when she was little, I bought a full-to-bursting bag of bulk candy from the union store and set it before her like an offering to a king. Deep in thought, she'd refused to try any of it, rolling her eyes at the very suggestion. When I returned from stepping out to take a call from my mother, I found her trying, very unsuccessfully, to bite into an everlasting gobstopper. With all my time spent in Sciences 442, the outside world grew more and more strange. Sometimes, spending a day in Holmes's lab made it feel like a bunker we'd stocked against a nuclear apocalypse and moved into before it happened. When Tom texted me to ask who I was taking to the dance, I found myself blinking hard in the lab's dim light, trying to remind myself that I could actually emerge into the unirradiated world and go. But I didn't have a date, and told myself I didn't want one. When I thought about the dance, I kept imagining it taking place at some other Sherringford, one where spending an evening with the most fascinating girl I knew meant disco balls and shitty music, not Bunsen burners and bloodstains. One where going out into a sea of my classmates would be something other than absolute torture. There was no way to forget I was a murder suspect, when people I didn't even know still stopped talking every time I walked into a classroom. Dobson's room was still roped off with yellow police tape. His former roommate Randall still tried to trip me in the hallways. My teachers all either handled me like glass or ignored me, except for whispery Mr. Wheatley, my creative writing teacher, who pulled me aside to say he was happy to listen if I ever needed an ear. I thanked him, though I didn't take him up on it. He was just offering because he was a nice guy. Even so, it felt good to have someone acknowledge, sanely, what was happening to me. Because the truth of it was I was terrified. I kept expecting to wake up dead. Someone out there had it in for Holmes and me, and we had no idea who it was. More accurately, I had no idea who it was. I had the sinking feeling that Holmes did, but she sat on her suspicions with the smug languor of a cat on a pillow. "I refuse to theorize in advance of the facts," was her response. "So, then let's go get some facts," I said. "Where do we start?" She drew her bow over her violin, thinking. "The infirmary," she said finally. Her plan was to see if Dobson, in the throes of arsenic poisoning, had tried to get help with his symptoms before his death. At first, I was a bit surprised that this was our next move. She'd done the tests and confirmed the poison's presence herself. Why did she need to dig up more evidence that it had killed him? We knew it had. But the more I thought about it, the more it made sense. Detective Shepherd had completely dismissed Holmes's claim that we were being framed. Every time I stepped out of the sciences building, I saw the plainclothes policeman he'd stationed by the front door. I caught him going through the dumpster outside my dorm. Holmes told me she'd woken one morning to find a team on a ladder, examining her dorm room's window from the outside. She was more shaken than she seemed, I could tell. From her stories and from the phone calls she still took regularly from her contact at Scotland Yard, I knew that Holmes wasn't used to working outside the law. Though she didn't say it out loud, I knew that she wanted to maneuver us back into the police's good graces. Having the school nurse corroborate our evidence would be a good first step.
She likes you, Holmes said dispassionately as we walked toward the infirmary, a small, squat addition to Harris Hall, with a few overnight beds and a dispensary.
Every time I'd been there in the past, cut up hands, busted nose, I'd been taken care of by the same nurse. I'd never thought she was anything but businesslike with me.
She likes me fine, I guess, I said.
So that's the plan? I fake some kind of injury, get her sympathy and her attention, and while she's busy, you go rooting around through her records?
Holmes blinked at me.
Yes, she said, and pushed the door open. The waiting room was empty. The nurse was finishing a game of Sudoku at the front desk.
Can I help you? She said, without looking up.
I'm back, I offered apologetically, holding up my hands. These were hurting again, and I was kind of worried I might have broken something.
Poor thing. She had a lilt to her voice that was oddly appealing. And your girlfriend here is for moral support.
I glanced over at Holmes, who managed a tearful smile.
I don't know if I can watch, she whispered. I'm just so worried about him. I think I have to wait out here.
The nurse put a reassuring hand on her arm.
I won't do anything horrible to him, I promise. You can't leave him now. Come, come.
She steered me and Holmes both back to the consulting room where she poked at my hands, which did, in fact, hurt, said that they were healing just fine, handed me some Tylenol, and dismissed us. The whole visit took about 5 minutes.
Well, Holmes said, scowling at the door behind us. That usually works a bit better than it did.
I smirked.
You might have to work on your caring girlfriend routine.
Is that it, then? No records?
No, she said. I'll break in around midnight and get what I need. It's just tedious having to dismantle the security cameras again.
Why didn't you just break in the first place?
Her smile flickered. You seem so eager to do something. I thought I might as well include you.
Thanks?
But tonight I'll go alone. You're about as stealthy as a lame elephant. See you later.
She patted me on the shoulder and took off down the path, leaving me behind, both charmed and insulted. The side effects of hanging around Charlotte Holmes. When I arrived at her lab the next day, after classes, Detective Shepherd was stepping out of the door. I hadn't known that he could interrogate either of us without a parent there, but he must have found a way to talk to Holmes.
Jamie, he said heavily, I'll see you in Charlotte on Sunday night at your father's house. We'll talk then.
With that, he fixed me with a pitying look and took off down the hall.
Wait, you're coming to that?
I called after him, but he didn't respond. Inside, on the love seat, Holmes was wrapped up in an avalanche of blankets. She looked like one of those Russian nesting dolls, like she was the smallest Holmes in a series. Whatever words she'd exchanged with Shepherd, they'd left her in a mood.
Why did you let him in? What was that about, exactly?
Nothing.
Nothing, I repeated.
I thought you were giving him Dobson's infirmary records.
He already had them, of course, she said. He chided me for breaking and entering, and left.
So Dobson did go to have his symptoms treated.
He went to the infirmary often, she said. Mostly rugby-related injuries, Shepherd said. He said they tested his hair for arsenic and found it and didn't need any of my proof. Then he asked me to identify all the vials on my poisons shelf, and then he left, saying he'd see us soon, in a voice I think he thought was threatening. Amateur.
Wait, back up. You let the detective in here. You let him look at your poisons shelf.
Yes.
Poisons?
Yes.
And there's arsenic on that shelf?
Yes.
And he's interrogating us again this Sunday, I said, feeling sick.
Yes, she said, drawing the word out like I was an idiot.
I stared at her for a long minute.
She had to know something she wasn't telling me.
Right. We need to make a list of possible suspects. We need to find something we can give them. Anything to make you, us, look less guilty.
Turning away, I taped a sheet of butcher paper to the side of her bookcase and wrote, suspects, at the top. Watson, she said, you don't have any suspects. I glared at her. She brought her cigarette to her lips and took a long drag. We'd reached an unspoken agreement. She'd dump the pill bottles, and I'd stop checking for them. That's how I chose to read the new and constant presence of a lit Lucky Strike in her hand, that she was trying out a drug that wouldn't kill her, at least not as quickly. But all that smoke meant the unventilated lab was starting to resemble some toxic back room of hell, edging me ever closer to my breaking point. And still Holmes sat and smoked and told me nothing. What about the person who checked out that copy of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from the library? There have to be records. Correction. That particular copy was new and had never once been checked out from the library. Someone stole it off the shelf, Holmes said. Currently, the library database has it listed as missing, and as the physical copy is in police possession, I have no way of examining it. What about enemies? We could list Dobson's enemies. Go on, then. Put down every girl at the school. Her eyes went dark. Though I can tell you that from the research I did last year, I know I'm the only one who had a run-in with him. I swallowed. We could list our enemies, then. You haven't got any enemies. I've got ex-girlfriends, I countered. English ones, American ones, Scottish ones. I could so see Fiona with some sort of tartan apothecary box for her poisons, although it was hard to actually imagine Fiona doing anything but dumping me in front of my entire class. Holmes raised an eyebrow. No, she said, and exhaled. I kept myself from pulling the cigarette from her hand and grinding it out on the floor. I haven't been sleeping, I told her, because I am worried that either you or I or some innocent lunch lady will bite it now that we've gotten ourselves a murderous fan club. So give me a hand, will you? Her eyes narrowed in concentration. The Marquess of Abergavenny, she said finally. I set fire to his stables when I was 9. Fine, I said, and then in a smaller voice. Can you spell that? She ignored me. I suppose you could add Christophe de Marchelier, the chemist, the Frenchman, not the Dane, and the Comtesse van Landingham. Tracy never liked me. She didn't like my brother Milo either, for that matter, but then he did break her heart. Oh, and the headmistress of Innsbruck School in Lucerne for beating us so often in chess, and the champion table tennis player Quentin Wilde. I suppose you might as well add his teammates Basil and Tom. Tom with an H, of course. Though I can't remember their surnames. Strange. Is that it, or are there peers and MPs that you're forgetting? Maybe a crowned head or two. She took a puff that sent her into a coughing fit. When she regained her composure, she said, Well, there's August Moriarty. As if that shouldn't have been the first name out of her mouth. What? I asked her slowly. Were you doing picking fights with a Moriarty? Professor James Moriarty was Sherlock Holmes's greatest enemy. In some ways, he was almost as notorious as the great detective himself. Moriarty was the first criminal mastermind of London, who famously died after fighting Sherlock Holmes at the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland. After that fight, Sherlock faked his own death in order to hunt down the rest of Moriarty's agents in disguise. Even Dr. Watson thought Sherlock was gone for good. Though the official story says differently, I have it on good authority that when Holmes waltzed back into his consulting room 3 years later, my great-great-great-grandfather delivered one hell of a punch to his former partner's jaw. Like I said before, I haven't had the best role models. But then neither had Charlotte Holmes. She dashed her cigarette out in the ashtray with a delicate, vicious hand. It's irrelevant. There was smothered hurt in her voice, but I couldn't afford to drop the subject. Professor Moriarty still has fans, Holmes. Followers. Did you know that some English serial killers still list him as their greatest inspiration? They've never recovered all the art he stole, not to mention the rest of his family actively attempting to live up to his legacy. I drew a line under his name. August. I had never heard of an August Moriarty. I mean, I know it's been more than 100 years, but I prefer to think, Holmes said, cutting me off, that we aren't all so mercilessly bound to our pasts. She rose, shedding her blankets. Underneath, she wore a short pleated skirt, rolled at the waist, to appear even shorter, and her white Oxford was undone to the fourth button. Had she dressed this way for the detective?